Greetings, dear, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Working Experience, a very warm, open-arm audio embrace and a squeeze. This episode is brought to you by my company, One Circle Media. One Circle Media is a hybrid digital agency and media content creator. We create and design apps, websites, videos, social media content, and physical products. We are artists, directors, designers, producers, coders, editors, thinkers, makers, and creators who embrace story and creativity from design, web and app development, animation, docs, features, TV shows, digital and social media content to physical products. For our clients, we create content that builds networks and audiences across multiple platforms. Check out our work at onecircledigital.com and onecirclebrand.com. If you work for a network, studio, brand, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I'd love to hear from you. This episode is also brought to you by an app that I created called Still Believe. Still Believe transforms a picture in your home into video proof of your child's favorite magical characters. With the app, parents can catch the magic of the Tooth Fairy, leaving money under their children's pillow, or Santa delivering presents on Christmas Eve in their home. You download the app, take a picture, and we create the magic. We utilize feature film visual effects artists to transform your picture into video. Just tell your kids that you have a special app that can detect and capture the Tooth Fairy, then present them with the video proof in the morning. The look on their faces is priceless. Your Still Believe video is created in minutes, and you can then save it to your phone and share it on social media. The app is available for the iPhone and Android, and it's free to download. Our aim is to bring joy and wonder into the hearts of children around the world. Check it out at stillbelieve.co. Thanks, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Working Experience.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Working Experience podcast. On today's episode, we have Professor Stephen Kahn, a history professor at Miami University, who's going to discuss his views on the importance of studying history and a little more specifically about MBA programs. So enjoy.
The Working Experience.
93 North is almost at a standstill. It's a rough one out there this morning. Snow and sleet.
There is no service on
the... Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Yeah, folks. We're going to be a few minutes. We have train traffic ahead of us. We should be moving shortly.
John, we need that report ASAP.
Where are we on that presentation?
Stan, HR wants to see you.
Did you return that email yet?
We have a team meeting at 10.
To stay late, Bob.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
They're moving in a different direction.
And after the meeting, we'll have a breakout session.
Who ate my biscuits?
Where are my hot pockets?
This microwave is disgusting.
Oh, God, what's that
smell? He was clipping his toenails at his desk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Working Experience podcast. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Kahn. He is the W.E. Smith Professor of History at Miami University. His teaching and research includes American cultural and intellectual history, public history, and urban history. And I am very glad to have him on the show. So welcome, Professor Kahn.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is it Kahn? Am I saying that correctly?
Correct.
Okay, very good. So if you could just tell us about maybe yourself, your background, educationally, sure. Professionally, how you came to be at the university, Miami University.
Yeah, sure. So I've been at this racket for about 25 years now. I wound up in graduate school in history. I won't exactly say by accident, but I hadn't intended to go to graduate school or become an academic, but after I graduated from college and I was out in the working world for a couple of years, I realized that I looked at the world through historical lenses. It just seemed to me that the questions that I was working on in my work, the sort of issues that mattered to me, I could only understand them if I thought about them historically. And so when I was in a particularly gruesome job, I woke up one morning and I thought, maybe I should quit this job and go to graduate school. So I did. And it was a terrific experience for me. After I finished up in grad school at the University of Pennsylvania down in Philadelphia, I wound up in the history department at Ohio State, which is the enormous land grant institution in the middle of Ohio, and was there for about 20 years. And then a few years ago, Miami University, which is it's close to Cincinnati, if people don't know the geography. It's the original Miami. We don't have the Cuban food or the beaches, but right. We're much older than the one in Florida. And so I went there about 5 years ago, and they made me a lovely position there. So that's how I got to where I am right now.
And you got your bachelor's from Yale University.
That's right. Correct? And I wasn't even a history major, shamefully. I went to Yale, and then I worked in the world of New England nonprofits for a while before I decided to go to graduate school.
Without being specific, you described your job before graduate school as gruesome. Could you just tell us in general what that industry was?
So as I said, I was working in and around the Boston area in some nonprofits, and I concluded that Puritanism didn't die; it became a 501c3. I found myself in this particular job the organizational goals of the place were really wonderful, and some of the work I did was really meaningful about social change and social justice, but I found myself surrounded by people, especially my supervisor, who were sort of burned out and miserable, and so they made the working experience also burned out and miserable. And the idea here was that you shouldn't complain about any of that or shouldn't try to rectify it, because the work you were doing was its own reward. That was that sort of puritanical streak that I found. And I always joked with people that when I wound up in graduate school, I didn't really take a pay cut. And people thought that was pretty funny, but actually it wasn't. It was pretty close to true. So you worked long hours for not very much money in a kind of sanctimonious environment. And after a while, I just decided I had enough of that.
You know, I was watching Jerry Seinfeld has a show, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Yeah. And he was talking to Bill Burr, who's from this area. I think he's from Canton. And it was like, where does that attitude come from? That kind of FU blah. And I can only ever trace all that back to Puritanism.
Many are the sins.
Just kind of miserable. I mean, I was born and bred here. I live outside Boston. I did live in New York for 20 years, which was a nice breath of fresh air. But yeah, it's sort of ingrained in the DNA.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's true.
Yeah. And my brother and sister-in-law both work for the federal government. And my brother had the same observation about people who work in that profession. Like, you have some of the worst people working to supposedly do good, but they're just horrible. They're just really, really very unpleasant, you know?
No, sort of busy saving the world, they've lost touch with their own humanity. And it's right. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Almost like... I think of nuns who I've known who justify being so horrible because they're entitled to be horrible because they're doing God's work.
That's correct. And my parents, still have the ruler scars on their knuckles to prove it.
I know. It's a strange hybrid up here. So you mentioned, a lot of things you were studying needed historical context, maybe I'd put it like that. So that's how you came to
it's how I understand the world, and it's how I need to understand the world. And I recognize that maybe that's a little weird. But as I look out at any contemporary landscape, and I mean that, pretty broadly, whether I'm looking at, a city street, or a political debate, or a social movement, what what I need to do is to process how we got to this point. And that's a historical question. How did these buildings wind up on this street? How did those people wind up in these streets demonstrating about this issue? The tagline for the American Historical Association, which is the big professional organization for historians in the country, is simply everything has a history. And that's, you know, that sums up for me how I look at the world.
You know, it's I finally finished The Power Broker. That was a tomb. Well, I have to attribute it to the coronavirus lockdown.
Right.
I had a lot of time. But, you know, like I said, I lived in New York for 20 years. But once you read that book, things that I just took for granted, I had no idea of the upheavals that took place to put this bridge in, that highway in. And
exactly.
It's you just look at it, as you say, through such a different lens.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the part of what's fun, but also, frankly, what's challenging about teaching history to students, whether they're high school students or college students, because I think they, as you just described, they assume that everything around them has always been this way. Mm-hmm. And the idea that it has changed over time is a kind of revelation to them, because they've just grown up this way, right? It's just always been like this, therefore. And when you begin to introduce that historicizing way of thinking, some of them get pretty excited.
Yeah, you know, I was a history major in college, and then I taught for a number of years in New York. And then I moved up to Massachusetts, finished my master's degree, and I was going to get a license to teach history. And my advisor said, listen, they have the gym teacher teaching history in a lot of districts. They have, because they don't test for it, we call it the MCAST here, it's the state test. And our history department routinely gets shafted on the budget. Their classes are overpaid, and it galls me. It really, I mean, these are not kids, these are adults who do not value history, or they very much undervalue it.
So I used to do a magic trick when I first got to Ohio State, and I was trying to figure out, you know, how to teach and the student population and so forth. And when I taught the introductory survey class, so it would be a class maybe of 250 students, on the first day, I would sort of introduce what we were going to try to do. And I would do a magic trick. I would point to somebody in the auditorium and I would say, okay, I'm going to tell you the first name of your high school American history teacher. And I would close my eyes and then I would say, coach. And I was never wrong. I nailed it every time. And I think, you know, so, but that points to a larger real problem. And that is that whatever people have complained about in terms of how schools teach math and science these days, and we've all kind of gone STEM crazy over the last few years, I think I could make a case that history suffers the worst in our school curriculum. I think it is taught by some people who aren't interested in doing it. And I think the ways that it gets taught to students are kind of woefully old fashioned. And so I have an interest in this because these are the students I then get in my classes. And I sort of have to undo some of the damage that got done when they were in high school.
What do you find is their attitude when they come into your class about history? I mean, are they excited about it? Are they like, oh, this is great? Or
So, you know, it depends a little bit on the level that I'm teaching. But certainly, I think many of them, if it's the first history class that they've taken in college, they come in with an expectation that it will simply be a bigger, faster version of what they did in high school. And what they did in high school, primarily, let me say, like 3 out of every 4 kids, what they did in high school was memorizing facts and then sort of regurgitating those facts back at periodic intervals in exams. Not very many of them get exposure to how you think historically. And that's, I think, the biggest leap that they have to take going from high school to college. That the facts are necessary, but that's not the end of it. And frankly, look, I think you can see this even in the public fights that we have in this society over historical topics. There are plenty of people out there who think that that history is just what happened. It's just the facts, and they get somewhat resentful when you try to engage with them to say, well, it's what these facts mean that really matters. The facts themselves are just kind of inert. Columbus, you know, sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Yes, that's a fact. Why does it matter? That's when it becomes really interesting, right? But that's, I think, what a lot of people get very tetchy about.
Well, I thought it was interesting on your department's page. It says, the study of the past prepares students to be informed citizens of the world today, which seems to speak to what you were talking about. Again, I always go back to the word context. Like, yes, Columbus sailed, you know, in 1492, came to America, but like, what's all the context, or why did he sail here? Yeah. Who was sponsoring it? What was the purpose?
Exactly.
So would you, I mean, if a student had to say to you, all right, why are we learning this? Like, what's the value in learning history? Like, what, I'm going out in the real world, I want a job.
Yep.
What is this going to do for me?
Yeah. So and believe me, I get asked that question all the time. I think there are a couple of answers, right? One answer that I think a lot of us have gotten trapped into is to say that a liberal arts education and a history major prepare you with a set of skills that are easily transferable across a wide range of careers and employment opportunities and so forth. What do we teach you to do as historians? We teach you to take a lot of information, a lot of sometimes random information, sift through it, digest it, understand it, and then make some meaning out of it. And what we also do in history is we do a lot of writing. So regardless of where you wind up in the world, chances are you're going to have to do some variation of that work. And history trains you to do that as well as anything and better than many disciplines. So that's sort of one set of answers. But as you were just getting at, the other set of answers is, I can't think of a more important discipline to train citizens in a democratic republic. It's not that I have cast any aspersions on my colleagues in the math department or in the sociology department or whatever, but understanding the political choices that you are faced with and are asked to make all the time as a citizen, if you want the best understanding of why we have these choices and what those choices might potentially mean, understanding how we got to these choices, I think, is the best way to do that. So it really is for me, and I teach American history, so in some ways it's easy. I don't do medieval France, but for me, this is about education for citizenship.
Would you say it, you know, would have a value to apply to, okay, why are we in this current political climate? Why are we tearing down statues? Why do we have Donald Trump as president?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No question. For me, this is all about the collision that we're seeing right now, a series of forces that have been in motion for a long time. And so understanding what those forces are, where they come from, I think makes you understand this moment, I think, more deeply than if you don't have that kind of understanding.
You know, I it was an interesting intellectual exercise for me when, you know, talking about the pandemic and polarization and all that, and I was talking about this with some friends the other day, like, imagine if you were born in 1900 and you lived to be 85 years old, like all the things you would have seen.
Yep.
World War One, World War Two, Spanish flu, the Holocaust. I mean, you would have thought the world was ending.
Yep.
You know, by the time you were 25 years old, Great Depression, maybe by the time you were 35 years old, you would have thought, this is it. I mean, we're
done. Yep. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I take as sort of a psychic balm, if you will, like we weren't done. And there's an author who I can't remember his name, but he writes about how civilization is actually very much more gentle now than it has been historically. I thought, yeah.
I think that's a really interesting argument to make. And yeah, the way I've always summarized it is that history is the best hedge against nostalgia. Because I think if you do have any understanding of the past, you realize that there really were no good old days. Maybe for you personally, but not for entire societies. The past was awful in a whole lot of ways. And so, yeah, I think that's exactly right. It gives you a perspective on things that you just, you know, you get it from reading literature, perhaps, but you just don't get it studying other things. And that's part for me. I'm never bored for that reason. It's just, that's what's really important to me.
I'm just finishing up a book called Camelot's Court about, John F. Kennedy and all. And again, things we just take for granted that, and, you know, a pretty good chunk of it is devoted to the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close we were to a terrible event, and how paranoid society was at that time, and understandably so.
Yeah, that's right. As I said, it for me, it's just the way I look at the world. And I recognize that not everybody does that, but my job is to persuade you that you should. That's the way I think about it.
So when you, just to shift gears a little bit, because I'm always interested in process, you do a lot of research, you've written articles, written books. How do you kind of latch on and say, okay, this is a topic that I want to explore? I mean, if you could like maybe give us an example of a topic you have explored and, you know, a little bit of idea of like, okay, how did I get onto this?
Yeah. That's a more complicated question than I wish it were. So I'll give you the example from my most recent book, which came out about 6 months ago. So this is the Department of Shameless Self-Promotion. The book I just did was, it's called Nothing Succeeds Like Failure, and it's a history of American business schools. Now, on the face of it, that sounds like maybe the most boring topic that you could imagine. So my promise to you is that it's not quite as boring as it seems. But here's how the idea came along. And this is literally true. About 4 years ago, beautiful October morning, I was walking to my office across campus, and I was walking past the university's business school, which is, you know, it looks like a kind of second-rate corporate office park, which is the style that a lot of these business schools have adopted.
They're getting them used to that whole thing.
Exactly. It's a kind of acculturation that they want the students to have.
Yeah.
So the sun is shining, and as I said, it's a beautiful October day, and I just happened to glance at this building, which I had never been in, and I said to myself, what the hell goes on in there? I have no idea. And I thought, well, that's a question I can answer. And so it literally was this sense that I have been on college campuses, you know, since graduate school, basically for 30 years, and I have no idea what happens in these business schools, which are nowadays, you know, enormous parts of campuses and an enormous part of higher education. So I thought, well, let's study this historically. Let's find out where the beginning was. Let's begin at the beginning and figure out why it is that American college campuses nowadays are so dominated by business schools. Without spoiler alert here, it's not a pretty story. But I had a lot of fun writing it. And that's literally what happened. It was an October morning. I went back to my office. I began to just sketch some ideas out in my head of things I might want to pursue. And then we were kind of off to the races. That's where that happened.
So where do you start your research? Do you start, I mean, would you go to Google and type in history of business schools? Do you interview people?
So, you know, so that's an interesting question to ask right at this very moment, because right now I'm starting a new book project, and that's really all I can do. Under normal circumstances, I would spend time in a library because there's still a lot out there that just actually isn't digitized yet and isn't digitally available and whatnot. So I would begin to, you know, to look at, right, who else has written about this topic? And let's grab a couple of those books and see what's going on. I would begin to look at old newspapers, where could I find some stuff that people have written about a topic, or old magazines, journals, whatnot. And then in this last book project, what I realized was that there were a handful of archival visits that I wanted to make. And so, I was able to schedule those around other stuff that I was doing. I was out in Denver, I was out in California, New York a couple of times. And I spent, a bunch of days with archival source materials, which just a minuscule fraction of that stuff is available online. That's really why if you're going to do that kind of historical work, you actually have to be there in person and get the boxes from storage.
Mm. Wow. So what is actually in those boxes when you go get them?
Well, all kinds of stuff, depending on where you're at. So one of the places that I was interested in looking at was the records of the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation published a whole lot of studies on business schools and business school curriculum and business, all kinds of things. They were very interested in this topic right after the Second World War. So they gave out a lot of grant money, and I wanted to look at those grant proposals. I wanted to look at the internal correspondence of people at the Ford Foundation about these projects, the reports that were issued by the grant recipients when the projects were over. And again, that stuff is only available if you go to the Archive Center and request it and as I said, have it shipped up from storage so you can sit there and go through it page by page.
You know, I remember reading, I've read the Lyndon Johnson series by Robert Caro, and he published a book last year just called Working or yep. On Working, and he described, and I've been to the Lyndon Johnson library outside of Austin, and I've seen those boxes he's describing.
Yeah.
And overwhelmed is not even the word. Like, they would bring up carts, and he's like, some of them were just labeled miscellaneous.
Yep.
And he describes just almost like diving into the middle, and you just got to see what's there.
No, it's in that sense, it's very much some combination of detective work and treasure hunting. Because I have certainly had the experience of going to an archive hoping to find certain kinds of materials, and then they're just not there, or nobody can find them. And then you walk away, kind of empty-handed, and you have to hit the reset button and start over again. I like doing archival research. I think that's part of the fun of being a historian, but it can be incredibly time-consuming. The very first archival project I ever did, and this was a long time ago, involved a woman. This was a project that was rooted in the mid-19th century, and there was a particular woman's correspondence that I wanted to look at, so I went down to this archive where it was at. As a young woman, let's say, I think she was in her early 20s, she'd suffered a gruesome horse riding accident, and so she had actually become a laudanum addict to deal with the pain. So by the time you would get to some of the end of these letters, the handwriting would become totally illegible. You could watch the effects of the laudanum he was taking, and it would just get loopy, and it would start to go in the wrong direction, and it would just. And so I I couldn't actually read like the last 20% of a lot of these letters because that's what happened to her. So you find stuff like that, which is really cool, but also really frustrating if you're trying to do your historical research.
Yeah, and it almost seems like you would be looking for one thing and you come across something else. You're like, ooh, that's interesting. Like,
that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the things that you get trained to do as a historian is really to let the sources speak to you. You may have a set of ideas about a particular topic, but if the archival source material is telling you something else, then you're obligated to listen and to change your preconceptions, ideas, hypotheses, whatever, in order to recognize what these sources are really saying.
I guess it must be hard. I've always struggled a little bit with autobiographies, particularly of people running for office, because I'm sort of like I can almost see it coming. I started to read one by Ted Kennedy, and oh God, it was just like, as I gazed out of my window at Hyannis, you already lost me, guy. I'm done with that. So, but I guess if you really respect somebody, you really admire somebody, and you're doing research, and you start to find some things that are not so respectable and laudable.
Well, I always thought that, you've already brought up Robert Caro a couple of times. I have always thought that doing a biography is, it's just not something I think I can do. I think it's really easy to write a biography because the narrative organizes itself, right? There's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end. So that's pretty easy. But I think it's really hard to write a good biography, because it is so tempting, I think, just to get lost in the weeds. You have this all this material. So when you read a bad biography, what you're getting is, you know, what somebody had for lunch on Tuesday, January 13th, and you just don't care. But this person, this writer, has found the stuff in the archive and they don't want to throw it away. So I think there are lots and lots of biographies out there, but the number of really good biographies, I think, is actually pretty small, in my opinion.
Yeah, I guess I'm always suspicious of agendas with anything, with movies or even fiction, or, just don't come to me with an agenda. Although I guess that's very difficult.
We all have our agendas. This is one of the things I think I work on with my students. I think that we have a kind of conventional understanding that we can be objective as historians. And I think, that's a pretty naive notion. We all bring a set of interpretive lenses. And so what you really need to do is to be honest, both with yourself, but also with your reader, about what those lenses are. You can't really do objective history. That's not really the goal. The goal is to do honest history.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of putting it. Yeah, being honest about where you're coming from.
Yep.
Yeah. So the reason I came across your work is we did a podcast on elite business schools cheating.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word, international students that, due to COVID-19. Like some guy from Brazil, he couldn't come. Cornell University wouldn't even refund his deposit of $2,000. Cornell University has many tens of millions of dollars in endowments and all of that. And then, we were talking about, before we started the podcast, the whole online thing. Their get out of jail free card seemed to be like, well, you can just take the courses online. And one student from Mumbai said, like, I'm not paying 170 grand to watch a YouTube channel. And it's like, business schools, it seems like 90% of it, it's networking, it's meeting people, it's internships. So you're never going to get that online.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think you're spot on.
And, this is what I'd never thought about it. I mean, this is why we do the podcast, too, because I didn't go to business school. I don't know anything about it particularly. But what caught my eye was you said, your quote was in the vein of, during recessions, business schools actually see an uptick in enrollment. And during good times, they don't. So I was wondering if you could, I mean, this podcast is called The Working Experience. We hope like people learn something from it. Why is that?
So I noticed this started to happen in the recession that started in the early 1970s. So before that, business schools on college campuses, everybody knew that the worst students went there. If you flunked out of the Spanish department, you went to the business school.
As late as the 1970s?
As late as, let's say, the late 60s, for sure.
Okay.
Yes, when a certain person might have been attending a certain Wharton business school, the worst students on campus were, and everybody knew this, right?
It was a kind of
open joke, an open secret. The recession in the 70s is when business schools got a lot more competitive because they were getting a lot more applicants, and the qualifications of these applicants all went up, their test scores, their GPAs, all that sort of stuff. So all of a sudden, what people began to notice was that the economic anxiety that the recession, you know, the stagflation 1970s recession was causing, business schools seem to be the safest harbor in that storm. And I think it has something to do with the fact that that's also the moment when the world of high paying blue collar employment is really shrinking, you know, that sort of deindustrial rust belt phenomenon. So where are you going to go to try to create some economic security for yourself? And it turns out that business schools became really appealing. So since the 1970s, business schools, by and large, have been recession proof. And in fact, you know, as I discovered, in the 1990s, when the economy was really hot, business school applications dropped a little bit, then they picked up again when the economy crashed at the beginning of this century. I think in the last almost 50 years, they really have been recession proof. Now, you know, what happens now? I don't know what kind of a parallel this particular event has, just given how extraordinary it is and given how nobody really understands how we're going to come out of it. But it wouldn't surprise me if students decide they want a business school degree because it's going to be a ferociously competitive job market out there, and they feel that that's the best credential to have to go out into that market.
The article said elite business schools cost upwards of $150,000 for the program, up into $170,000. People take out loans and, you know, just crushing debt. Do you think it's worth it to get an MBA?
Well, so worth it is, let's disentangle that a little bit. So at the elite business schools, there are, so what are we talking about here? We're talking about Harvard, Penn, you know, Stanford, Columbia, Chicago, Northwestern. Some number of those MBA students are actually getting their ride paid for them by the companies that they already work for. Deutsche Bank is going to send you off to get buffed and polished for 2 years before you come back to move up the ladder at Deutsche Bank or, you know, whatever it is. So is it worth it in terms of your future income earning? There's some indication that that's probably true in the MBA world. There's not a lot of indication that that's true for undergraduate business degrees. They don't really, you know, they'll get you a job quickly out of college, but 5-10 years out of college, you're making about the same amount of money as the philosophy major. And that's, I think, something that business schools don't want you to say out loud. Is it worth it in terms of, do you actually learn anything? So what is it exactly that you're paying for? Then I think we get into some pretty murky waters, and it isn't clear that there is much at the academic center of a business school education.
What, you know, who came up with this phenomenon that you're working at a company, a Deutsche Bank, let's say, why would they come up with the idea that we need to send you to school to come back and essentially do the job you're doing now, or you would learn on the job? I've always been curious about that phenomenon. Like,
yeah,
who, it almost seems like a racket, like somehow this, like there's some collusion. I don't know, like how they come up with that.
So, you are not entirely wrong. So let's go back to the very beginning of the business school. The very first collegiate business school was none other than the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, where the current occupant of the White House got his degree, as he will remind you at every opportunity.
Yes.
Founded in 1881. And it was founded primarily, and again, I waded through all this research. The major purpose of these business schools was to provide a certain kind of social cachet to a businessman. They wanted to be perceived socially like doctors and lawyers, and in the late 19th century, also as ministers, all of whom had to get college degrees, right? You had to go to college to become a doctor. You had to go to law school to become a lawyer. But any high school dropout could become a businessman. And so this was really about social status more than anything else. Because again, there isn't an academic rationale for it. There isn't a disciplinary body of knowledge that that you need to have in order to be a businessman. You know, as I said, you can be a high school dropout and become a very successful businessman. The tales of the high school dropout who becomes a world famous neurosurgeon are pretty rare.
You know?
So it really is about this notion that we want the business people wanted to be taken seriously, and a college degree became a form of cultural capital for them. That's how these business schools started. And I would argue that's still the answer to your question. When Deutsche Bank sends you off to the Columbia Business School to get your MBA, it can now boast on its website that they have a graduate from Columbia University with an MBA. That's it. It's all about that, as I said, that sort of social status, social cachet, cultural capital. That's really what this is about.
You know, it reminds me of, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, I was going to say that maybe the most single egregious example of this that I stumbled on, there may be others, is the relationship the Harvard Business School has with McKinsey Consulting and the kind of back and forth that goes on between those two operations is it's incestuous, if that's quite the right way to describe an institution. And I was talking to a young woman who'd been hired out of college at McKinsey, and she was asking me about this. She said, you know, people keep saying that in a couple of years I'll go to Harvard, and they call it going on summer vacation. So that you'll work McKinsey for a little while, then you'll go to the Harvard Business School, then you'll come back to McKinsey. But you'll come back at a slightly higher salary and at a different position and so on and so forth. So yeah, as I said, it's all about, it's not about the skills that you learn in a business school or the knowledge that you acquire. It's about this cachet.
You know, it puts me in mind of, my father was an attorney, and he had a friend on the West Coast, went into the stock market, made a lot of money. I think he did go to college. And he was joking with him years later. They were both in their 70s. And he said, geez, you couldn't get your job now without an advanced degree. And he said, in all seriousness, I could not get my assistant's job. He said he had this kid who was very sharp, he had to leave to go to get a business degree. And this guy was like, why are you making him leave? He knows what he's doing.
No, and my grandfather is a similar story. My grandfather, you know, he is the great post-war American success story. He graduated from high school. Yes, he did. And he went to work in the mailroom of a big Manhattan insurance company They kept his job for him when he went off to the Second World War, and he retired as some kind of a vice president. And by the time he retired, which was, you know, let's say the mid-80s, he fully acknowledged that there was no way. I mean, he was now surrounded by people with MBAs, and he had a high school degree, had worked his way up. And right. So I think that whole world really starts in the 70s when the credential is a way of competing in a job market.
You know, there's this really funny, I think with a FedEx commercial, the woman, the guy's a new hire, and she said, yeah, we get our packages delivered here. You just go on. And the guy goes, well, I have an MBA. And she goes, all right, let me show you how to do this. Meaning like, you don't know how to do anything. Yeah. You know how to do. Well, you know,
that's one of the wonderful things that I discovered in my research is that some of the fiercest critics of business schools over the decades have been people in business who say, oh my God, these graduates, they don't know anything, but they're really arrogant. It's a funny dynamic. A lot of businesses don't think that business schools are churning out valuable employees, but you know, but there we are.
Well, you know, kind of wrap up and circle back when we started talking about this, you know, we just take things for granted. Like, no, there's always been MBA programs.
Right.
No, you have to get, it's like, well, who said that? I mean,
right.
Go back to the 1950s, 40s, you know, it's amazing how these things just become writ when you're like, well, wait a minute. Why is anybody asking why?
Yes.
Well, I guess money is always the answer to that. People are making a lot of money out of it.
Yep.
So.
Well, yeah, there's a demand. And, you know, I think there is a kind of, you know, Emperor's New Clothes or Wizard of Oz behind the curtain quality to all of this, that if we were actually to do an honest evaluation of these places, we might get pretty embarrassed. But, you know, I will also say that it's not even a demand on the part of students. That I've found over the years, because I've had plenty of them in my office. I haven't had a single business major, and I can say that I'm not being hyperbolic here. I haven't had a single business major in my office ever in 25 years who enjoyed what they were doing or thought it was interesting. They are doing it because their mom told them to. So these students go off to college and their parents are telling them that you better major in marketing. Because that's, you know, because we're paying for your college and that's how you're going to get a good job. It's a very weird dynamic.
Yeah. And I mean, it's very understandable. But a friend of mine posed that to me about teaching. He said, well, you know, people who work on Wall Street are not going to do their job for $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you?
Yeah, exactly.
So it tells you they don't like it at
that's
all.
Correct.
I thought, yeah, that's a good way to... Sorry, what were you saying?
I was going to say, I think there's been an interesting, the last 3 months have made some of this maybe a little more apparent than it has been before. In the state of Ohio, at any rate, I don't know about Massachusetts, but when the governor kind of shut us all down and the health director, who was magnificent, sort of put the lockdown in place, teachers were on the list of essential workers. Hedge fund managers were not. So there you go, right? Garbage collection, teaching, food service workers, but not guys in private equity.
Well, so were liquor stores. And not libraries, though. My library still isn't open.
We're starting to open ours up. You do curbside delivery right now, and then the building's probably going to open up next month. So we're getting there.
All right. Well, that's good. Well, hey, Professor Kahn, thank you so much for doing this. It was a great conversation.
This was fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Working Experience. We'd like to thank our sponsors, One Circle Media and the Still Believe app, the only app that delivers video proof of the Tooth Fairy and Santa by simply taking a picture. Download the app at stillbelieve.co today and amaze your kids. And if you work for a studio, network, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain your audience, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I would love to hear from you. And that's it. The end. The sweet end. Until our next audio encounter.